Today we'll be continuing The Great Gatsby by F. Scott Fitzgerald. Chapter 7, Part 2.
"I've made a small investigation of this fellow," he continued. "I could have gone deeper if I'd known."
"Do you mean you've been to a medium?" inquired Jordan humorously.
"What?"
Confused, he stared at us as we laughed.
"A medium?
About Gatsby."
"About Gatsby? No, I haven't. I said I'd been making a small investigation of his past."
"And you found he was an Oxford man?" said Jordan helpfully.
"An Oxford man?"
He was incredulous.
"Like hell he is. He wears a pink suit."
"Nevertheless, he is an Oxford man."
"Oxford, New Mexico," snorted Tom contemptuously. "Or something like that."
"Listen, Tom, if you're such a snob, why did you invite him to lunch?" demanded Jordan crossly.
"Daisy invited him. She knew him before we were married. God knows where."
We were all irritable now with the fading ale, and aware of it, we drove for a while in silence. Then, as Dr. T.J. Eckelberg's faded eyes came into sight down the road, I remembered Gatsby's caution about gasoline.
"We've got enough to get us to town," said Tom.
"But there's a garage right here," objected Jordan. "I don't want to get stalled in this baking heat." Tom threw on the brakes impatiently, and we slid to an abrupt, dusty stop under Wilson's sign. After a moment, the proprietor emerged from the interior of his establishment and gazed hollow-eyed at the car.
"Let's have some gas," cried Tom roughly. "What do you think we stopped for, to admire the view?"
"I'm sick," said Wilson without moving.
"Been sick all day. What's the matter?"
"I'm all run down."
"Well, shall I help myself?" Tom demanded. "You sounded well enough on the phone."
With an effort, Wilson left the shade in support of the doorway and, breathing hard, unscrewed the cap of the tank. In the sunlight, his face was green.
"I didn't mean to interrupt your lunch," he said, "but I need money pretty bad, and I was wondering what you were going to do with your old car." "How do you like this one?" inquired Tom.
"I bought it last week."
"It's a nice yellow one," said Wilson as he strained at the handle. "Like to buy it?"
"Big chance."
Wilson smiled faintly. "No, but I could make some money on the other." "What do you want money for all of a sudden?"
"I've been here too long. I want to get away. My wife and I want to go west."
"Your wife does?"
exclaimed Tom, startled.
"She's been talking about it for 10 years.
He rested for a moment against the pump, shading his eyes.
"And now she's going, whether she wants to or not. I'm going to get her away."
The coupe flashed by us with a flurry of dust and the flash of a waving hand.
"What do I owe you?" demanded Tom harshly. "I just got wised up to something funny the last 2 days, remarked Wilson. "That's why I want to get away. That's why I've been bothering you about the car. What do I owe you?"
$1.20. The relentless beating heat was beginning to confuse me, and I had a bad moment there before I realized that so far his suspicions hadn't alighted on Tom. He had discovered that Myrtle had some sort of life apart from him in another world, and the shock had made him physically sick. I stared at him, and then at Tom, who had made a parallel discovery less than an hour before, and it occurred to me that there was no difference between men, in intelligence or race, so profound as the difference between the sick and the well. Wilson was so sick that he looked guilty, unforgivably guilty, as if he had just got some poor girl with child.
"I'll let you have that car," said Tom. "I'll send it over tomorrow afternoon."
That locality was always vaguely disquieting, even in the broad glare of the afternoon. And now I turned my head as though I'd been warned of something behind. Over the ash heaps, the giant eyes of Dr. T.J. Eckelberg kept their vigil. But I perceived, after a moment, that other eyes were regarding us with peculiar intensity from less than 20 feet away. In one of the windows over the garage, the curtains had been moved aside a little, and Myrtle Wilson was peering down at the car. So engrossed was she that she had no consciousness of being observed. And one emotion after another crept into her face, like objects into a slowly developing picture. Her expression was curiously familiar. It was an expression I had often seen on women's faces, but on Myrtle Wilson's face it seemed purposeless and inexplicable, until I realized that her eyes wide with jealous terror, were fixed not on Tom, but on Jordan Baker, whom she took to be his wife. There is no confusion like the confusion of a simple mind. And as we drove away, Tom was feeling the hot whips of panic. His wife and his mistress, until an hour ago, secure and inviolate, were slipping precipitately from his control. Instinct made him step on the accelerator with double purpose of overtaking Daisy and leaving Wilson behind. And we sped along toward Astoria at 50 miles an hour, until, among the spidery girders of the elevated, we came in sight of the easygoing blue coupe. "Those big movies around 50th Street are cool," suggested Jordan. "I love New York on summer afternoons when everyone's away. There's something very sensuous about it. Overripe, as if all sorts of funny fruits were going to fall into your hands." The word sensuous had the effect of further disquieting Tom. But before he could invent a protest, the coupe came to a stop, and Daisy signaled us to drop alongside. "Where are we going?" she cried. "How about the movies?" "It's so hot," she complained. "You go. We'll ride around and meet you after." With an effort, her wit rose faintly. "We'll meet you on some corner. I'll be the man smoking two cigarettes." "We can't argue about it here," Tom said impatiently, as a truck gave out a cursing whistle behind us. "You follow me to the south side of Central Park in front of the plaza." Several times he turned his head and looked back for their car. And if the traffic delayed them, he slowed up until they came into sight. I think he was afraid they would dart down a side street and out of his life forever. But they didn't. And we took the less explicable step of engaging the parlor of a suite in the Plaza Hotel. The prolonged and tumultuous argument that ended by herding us into that room eludes me, though I have a sharp physical memory that in the course of it, my underwear kept climbing like a damp snake around my legs, and intermittent beads of sweat raced cool across my back. The notion originated with Daisy's suggestion that we hire 5 bathrooms and take cold baths, and then assumed more tangible form as a place to have a mint julep. Each of us said over and over that it was a crazy idea. We all talked at once to a baffled clerk and thought, or pretended to think, that we were being very funny. The room was large and stifling. And though it was already 4 o'clock, opening the windows admitted only a gust of hot shrubbery from the park. Daisy went to the mirror and stood with her back to us, fixing her hair. "It's a swell suite," whispered Jordan respectfully, and everyone laughed. "Open another window," commanded Daisy without turning around. "There aren't any more. Well, we'd better telephone for an axe." "The thing to do is to forget about the heat," said Tom impatiently. "You make it 10 times worse by crabbing about it." He unrolled the bottle of whiskey from the towel and put it on the table. "Why not let her alone, old sport?" remarked Gadsby. "You're the one that wanted to come to town." There was a moment of silence. The telephone book slipped from its nail and splashed to the floor. Whereupon Jordan whispered, "Excuse me." But this time no one laughed. "I'll pick it up," I offered. "I've got it." Gadsby examined the parted string, muttered "hum" in an interested way, and tossed the book on a chair. "That's a great expression of yours, isn't it?" said Tom sharply. "What is?" "All this old sport business. Where'd you pick that up?"
"Now see here, Tom," said Daisy, turning around from the mirror. "If you're going to make personal remarks, I won't stay here a minute. Call up and order some ice for the mint julep."
As Tom took up the receiver, the compressed heat exploded into sound, and we were listening to the portentous chords of Mendelssohn's Wedding March from the ballroom below.
"Imagine marrying anybody in this heat," cried Jordan dismally.
"Still, I was married in the middle of June," Daisy remembered. "Louisville in June. Somebody fainted."
"Who was it fainted, Tom?"
"Biloxi," he answered shortly. "A man named Biloxi. Blocks Biloxi, and he made boxes. That's a fact. And he was from Biloxi, Tennessee." "They carried him into my house," appended Jordan, "because we lived just 2 doors from the church. And he stayed 3 weeks until Daddy told him to get out. The day after he left, Daddy died." After a moment, she added, as if she might have sounded irreverent, "There wasn't any connection." "I used to know a Bill Biloxi from Memphis," I remarked. "That was his cousin. I knew his whole family history before he left.
He gave me an aluminum putter that I use today. The music had died down as the ceremony began, and now a long cheer floated in at the window, followed by intermittent cries of yay, and finally by a burst of jazz as the dancing began. "We're getting old," said Daisy. "If we were young, we'd rise and dance." "Remember Biloxi?" Jordan warned her. "Where'd you know him, Tom?"
"Biloxi?"
He concentrated with an effort.
"I didn't know him. He was a friend of Daisy's."
"He was not," she denied. "I'd never seen him before. He came down in the private car."
"Well, he said he knew you. He said he was raised in Louisville. Asa Bird brought him around at the last minute and asked if we had room for him."
Jordan smiled. "He was probably bumming his way home. He told me he was president of your class at Yale." Tom and I looked at each other blankly.
"Biloxi?"
"First place, we didn't have any president." Gatsby's foot beat a short, relentless tattoo as Tom eyed him suddenly.
"By the way, Mr. Gatsby, I understand you're an Oxford man."
"Not exactly."
"Oh yes, I understand you went to Oxford."
"Yes, I went there."
A pause.
Then Tom's voice, incredulous and insulting. "You must have gone there about the time Biloxi went to New Haven."
Another pause.
A waiter knocked and came in with crushed mint and ice, but the silence was unbroken by his thank you and the soft closing of the door.
This tremendous detail was to be cleared up at last.
"I told you I went there," said Gatsby. "I heard you, but I'd like to know when." "It was in 1919. I only stayed 5 months. That's why I can't really call myself an Oxford man."
Tom glanced around to see if we mirrored his unbelief. But we were all looking at Gatsby.
"It was an opportunity they gave to some of the officers after the armistice," he continued. "We could go to any of the universities in England or France."
I wanted to get up and slap him on the back. I had one of those renewals of complete faith in him that I'd experienced before. Daisy rose, smiling faintly, and went to the table. "Open the whiskey, Tom," she ordered, "and I'll make you a mint julep. Then you won't seem so stupid to yourself. Look at the mint."
"Wait a minute," snapped Tom. "I want to ask Mr. Gatsby one more question."
"Go on," Gatsby said politely.
"What kind of a row are you trying to cause in my house anyhow?"
They were out in the open at last, and Gatsby was content.
"He isn't causing a row."
Daisy looked desperately from one to the other.
"You're causing a row. Please have a little self-control."
"Self-control?"
repeated Tom incredulously.
"I suppose the latest thing is to sit back and let Mr. Nobody from Nowhere make love to your wife. Well, if that's the idea, you can count me out. Nowadays, people begin by sneering at family life and family institutions, and next they'll throw everything overboard and have intermarriage between black and white."
Flushed with his impassioned gibberish, he saw himself standing alone on the last barrier of civilization.
"We're all white here," murmured Jordan.
"I know I'm not very popular. I don't give big parties. I suppose you've got to make your house into a pigsty in order to have any friends in the modern world."
Angry as I was, as we all were, I was tempted to laugh whenever he opened his mouth. The transition from libertine to prig was so complete.
"I've got something to tell you, old sport," began Gatsby.
But Daisy guessed at his intention.
"Please don't," she interrupted helplessly. "Please, let's all go home. Why don't we all go home?"
"That's a good idea."
I got up.
"Come on, Tom. Nobody wants a drink. I want to know what Mr. Gatsby has to tell me." "Your wife doesn't love you," said Gatsby. "She's never loved you. She loves me."
"You must be crazy,"
exclaimed Tom automatically. Gatsby sprang to his feet, vivid with excitement.
"She never loved you, do you hear?" he cried. "She only married you because I was poor and she was tired of waiting for me. It was a terrible mistake, but in her heart she never loved anyone except me."
Thank you for joining Bite at a Time Books today, while we read a bite of one of your favorite classics. Again, my name is Bree Carlisle, and I hope you come back tomorrow for the next bite of The Great Gatsby.